All right, everybody, welcome back to the Front Side, the podcast, episode whatever.
I think we're on episode eight.
Nice.
Yeah, we made it. That's about twice as far as I thought we'd ever make it. So that's good.
Yeah, and it's almost been 8 weeks. Like it's almost 1 week. Have we ever done a double decker or a double header?
I don't think so, Charles. I don't think we've done anything. I don't think we've done anything resembling 1 a week in this.
I don't think the world would be quite ready for that.
I think it's been like 6 months actually. So we're, but I'm okay with this pace. I don't think the world is ready to hear everything that we have to say in the entire office. Otherwise, they'd all work with us already.
It's about precision and accuracy, my friend, not consistency.
That's right. So yeah, it was a good week here at the Front Side. A lot of ember, a lot of work. And this is the part where we unwind. We just got back from our first real company outing. Which was kind of weird. We went and saw a movie about monkeys or apes or something. I forget.
They had hair and they and emotions.
Jeffrey had a good point about it. He said that it was the he said it was the most philosophical movie he'd ever seen that had monkeys jumping off of horses dual wielding machine guns.
Yeah, I want to play the first person shooter version of that.
That's an awesome idea. All right, I'm sold. Like, why are we doing this instead of programming that video game right now?
Exactly. You want one? You can have like the double wielding machine gun thing on top of the horse, and then later on you can like flip through Kant and Heidegger and stuff like that.
You know, sometimes you can sell a movie by saying it's like Die Hard, in an airplane or something like that. You can sell investors on this video game by saying it's Halo with monkeys. I'm sold. I don't know. Just shut up and take my money, I guess.
You know what? Almost that thing where he jumped on the tank, that almost felt like you were driving. What's the tank in Halo called? Man, it's been so long.
The Scorpion.
The Scorpion, yeah. It almost felt like you were inside a Scorpion.
I have revealed too much of my video game knowledge, and we must change the subject.
All right. Well, do we have a subject picked out for today?
I think we do. I think we have something that you and I have talked about that is definitely worth covering, and I'm curious to get more of your thoughts. We started talking about it. I was like, no, wait, save it for the podcast, because this is actually something I really want to hear your opinion on.
So basically,
to crack it open a little bit, it was basically the idea was about snowflakes and teams and frameworks and people who hate all of those things or like all of those things or something like that. So if you would kindly delineate and kind of help me untangle that web of thought.
Right. Well, we're fans of frameworks, or rather, we're not so much fans of frameworks. We're big fans of not writing code that we don't have to write, and concentrating our energy that way. But one of the things that I've certainly encountered a lot and encountered in the wild is the idea that as a programmer, if you use an off-the-shelf component or you use an existing library or you use a framework, especially frameworks are particularly get this criticism a lot, you'll find this idea out there that this somehow makes you replaceable as a
Like a cog or something.
Yeah, like a cog. Like, you know, if you're using Rails or you're using Spring or you're using Django or whatever, because that's kind of the framework that you're working in, you can be kind of picked up, moved over here, and dropped in to another place. And that kind of makes sense at a certain level, because, you know, the uniqueness is contained inside the framework. And so you have a lot of people with a shared knowledge about a single code base. And so a lot of different people can come to work on that code base without prior knowledge. And so I think that on its surface, this idea has a lot of appeal, and people think, shit, man, I'm not really interested in this, or I need to work against this because, you know, I'm just making myself obsolete. And I think that I was actually having a conversation with one of our clients, and you know, he had a very, very interesting take on it about how it, perhaps counterintuitively the opposite is true, and that by using as much standard open source frameworked style stuff, you actually increase your value to the business and you increase your job security and make yourself more indispensable. And the way that that works is because when you're working inside that code base, your mental energy, all your creativity and all your innovation, and as a result, all of the kind of intrinsic tribal knowledge that you're generating and acquiring is in proportion very high to the specificity or the unique business that you're working for. In other words, if I'm working on a Rails code base, I'm spending no time doing, you know, working with the HTTP stack. I'm spending no time with rendering templates. I'm spending no time on, you know, how do I make this extensible with middleware? I'm spending no time with resourcefulness and routing and you know, maybe perhaps no time on low-level database stuff. All of my time is spent working on what makes this business. And so from that perspective, all of the knowledge that you've gained, because it's around the business, makes you indispensable to that business. It makes you more valuable. Whereas if you've spent all this time doing something completely custom, well, then someone can just come in and say, oh, but we could do everything that you're doing with one of these frameworks. And so it actually is not as vital to your
I know what you mean. Like somebody once told me a story about a coworker that they had, and they worked in Java kind of around the time that Rails came out. And this programmer was scoffing at Rails, like, Rails is so stupid. And this programmer's entire job was to build CRUD interfaces, and they were very, very good at it. It would take them a week, and they could crank out a CRUD interface to access the database. They had a custom written tool set in Java. It would talk to the database. It would save the stuff out. It would convert it to convert the stuff that a user would input into things to send to the model and back and forth. And that was the CRUD person. And it's interesting how Rails made people think differently about whether that was core to a business's, like, okay, it costs us, you know, $100,000+ to build, to have a person that knows CRUD interfaces well enough to build CRUD interfaces all day. Is that a core business concept of ours? Like that person's information is so technically specific and so disconnected or decoupled from anything relating to business logic. Like, literally, I can't tell you what business that person worked in because there's no context there. That could have been in any business, and you would think, well, that makes me more portable, and instead it made them completely replaceable as soon as somebody automated that stuff.
Right, exactly.
Talk about your all-time backfires.
Yeah.
Like, you know, how much is that person worth now? Like, I can't think of a company that I respect that would hire somebody who's like, yeah, I'm really good at CRUD interfaces and that's all I do. Like, wow, we just have no use for that.
Right, right. Well, I certainly hope that they manage to move on.
I hope so too. People have a way of adapting once there's actually, you know, once there are bills to pay and stuff. But it's a weird thing to hang on to.
Right, right. And it's such a counterintuitive result that by using as much commodity stuff as possible, you are the snowflake. Then you are the unique snowflake, and more irreplaceable.
I want to
that you should use that as a weapon or anything.
Can we dive into the psychology of this a little bit? Because you and I have both encountered people who react violently to this concept, who feel so strongly about the way that frameworks turn people into automatons or whatever. We've met people that react so strongly to that. It's surprising if you don't understand kind of what that thought process is. Do you have thoughts on what that, like, I haven't actually pulled that apart. I don't really understand what's going on there, but
I think there's a bunch of different angles. I mean, it's funny. As much as I've encountered it, I haven't thought about the problem like holistically, but I can point to a couple of different reactions that I think are concrete and might hold. And the first one you kind of already touched on is, you know, people who specialized or were experts in doing something that is now done by a framework. So they feel threatened because it's threatening them with obsolescence, where this knowledge that was very precious and difficult to come by, and they spent years doing hard work and probably lots of innovation and pouring in creative energy, is now commodity. And that can be, I think, very psychologically hard to deal with. And that has an offshoot too, is that there might be certain flaws in the framework. There might be things that it does that you don't like. And because you have expertise in this area, because you've invested so much time, you're able to perceive those flaws or see those shortcomings. And because you've worked with solutions that for that particular problem you've used or came up with or borrowed better solutions, the fact that it's not there or doesn't fit well with this particular framework, it can turn you off the whole thing and make you react violently to it and say, okay, no, I'm going to throw the whole thing out and reject it out of hand. Especially if the shortcoming is around some area that you felt a lot of pain with in the past. I know certainly for me, this was a problem for me with Active Record from early on. Not only because I'd worked a lot writing my own database layers quite a bit, like first in Perl and later working with JDBC and Java and then working with Hibernate, coming to something like Active Record, it felt very dumbed down. It felt like it felt constrictive, and it felt, I don't know, there was a lot to be desired there. And as a result, I know, maybe about 4 years ago, it made me push myself back from the table and say, you know what, I'm not going to do Rails anymore because this is ridiculous. This is out of hand. It's constraining. And so I'm going to go off and I'm going to write all my applications with Sinatra and DataMapper. And that ended really, really well.
as all of those stories go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so basically, I think it's weird. It feels like it's kind of a watershed that every developer has to cross at some point. Like everybody I've talked to of some experience and maturity level in software, certainly that I respect, will admit, like, yes, there was this time where I thought I had to do everything myself because everybody else is an idiot and every other thing that is out there is not as good as the thing that I could come up with myself. And I there's almost a trope around this idea of every developer has the write a framework moment where they say, you know what, I'm just going to write a framework for this, before they realize that writing a framework was mostly a solution to the problem of they didn't realize how hard it was to write a framework. And I guess that's part of it. So what I want to kind of dive into a little bit is like look into these different businesses. One of the cool things about working in a consultancy is you get to kind of be a little bit of a tourist in other people's businesses and in these cultures and experience different cultures pretty rapidly. And what I've noticed both in working in companies of varying sizes and in working alongside them as a consultant is that there is this tendency for people to kind of often reject the idea of a framework because it doesn't represent a 100% zero impedance mismatch, hand in glove type fit with what the business's needs are and what their software does. But it has this most ironic effect is most times when we wind up having to rehabilitate code bases, it's not because they I'm trying to think of how to say this delicately. It's most of the time it's not because the code is so terrible or poorly architected. I'm now seeing, and maybe this was true a few years ago when Rails shops were new, mm-hmm. but most of the code we rehabilitate is over-engineered rather than under-engineered, and done by people who are rejecting the idea of frameworks and saying, hey, these frameworks don't map to our business. And then you're like, well, what part of building your own persistence framework was core to your business? Like, and then you calculate the amount of money that they've spent digging that hole and then filling it back in again and trying to build something on top of it. You calculate that out and you go, okay, a startup has, you know, a couple of million dollars in a year long or 2 year long life cycle. You know, you got a few million dollars to play with, and you've got about 18 months before your investors come burn down your house and, you know, carry you off with pitchforks. So what do you do with that time? What I'm frequently seeing is that first $1 million often is torched in the process of building tools. And I've now seen this enough times that I'm starting to worry that it's a trend. And I don't know if it's purely in the Ruby community or if this is common in other communities as well. But I'm seeing this time and overhead that certainly startups don't have time for, and probably contributes a lot to the kind of drag that you see in larger organizations. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a little bit heartbreaking because you look at that and realize like these developers missed an opportunity to focus exclusively or primarily on things that are core to that business. So if you're right. and like you said earlier, like it really is about the code that you don't write.
Right. And it's funny because I think part of it has to do with this mythos of the startups being about the technology. And I certainly bought into that when I was a lot younger. And I think that for some startups, it definitely holds true. You know, if you're doing some sort of unique indexing or you're doing some sort of signal processing or some, you know, you've got something that's really, truly unique intellectual property, maybe you want to, but even then you're going to be writing a lot of custom code, but not around the areas that are off the shelf, like things like, you know, persistence frameworks and stuff. If that is what you want to do, I really think that, you know, I think that I'm coming to think, whereas I used to think that this was kind of the business of startups was to do a lot of experimentation in terms of technology. I think for startups, you want to try and do as little experimentation. Like startups are the new enterprise. Startups should be so conservative about the technologies that they use because most of them are about their business model. Whereas enterprises are the ones where real innovation or real crazy experimentation ought to happen. You know, some of our bigger clients, you know, I think that they, you know, the smart ones, they have two tracks where they're, you know, they're kind of almost like a you know, some sort of like feeder system for the highway where you've got the major highway and then your small roads that kind of branch off and come in to that major highway. But if they're doing it right, then they've got a big mainstream, but they're also going out and investing large amounts of money in prototypes that are going to be thrown away, you know, writing services in Go and doing all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
In addition to their core business, but for the startups, I think like nowadays, startups actually should be the ones that are more conservative to the enterprise. I think that sounds crazy, but you know, maybe that's the way that things are going.
Well, and one thing that I want to kind of like you touched on a moment ago that I want to reinforce is this idea that you mentioned unique intellectual property, and I've worked for several shops that completely hung their hat on the unique intellectual property that they'd created with no regard as to the actual business value of that unique intellectual property. But, you know, say what you want about the tenets of, you know, crazed intellectual property obsession, at least it's an ethos. And they, you know, it was something, and it could have represented, you know, potential acquisition. It could have represented a unique spot in the marketplace. So we had all of these developers, and they were taking a framework that everybody knew and loved and was working in, and they spun off, and almost all of their time was in experimentation with business model stuff. You know, those people knew the domain so well. They like I could go back and criticize that development team a little bit but mostly they were really focused on stuff that added unique value to that business, and it wasn't necessarily because they chose a framework. It just kind of they chose a framework because they were so fascinated by the problem domain that happened to be tied to the business that's where they wanted to innovate and experiment. And they did stuff. They were doing stuff that when I explained, this is like 5-6 years ago, and when I explained what we were doing in those days now to people, people are still amazed by it. The kind of technology that was built is still novel because people don't attempt stuff that ambitious today often. And so It's not saying that everybody, you know, should have a startup that just is basically a CRUD app that, you know, takes information in and stores it in a database and then experiment with how to sell that to people. But if you the parts of experimentation that you do, if you do need a service in Go, or if you do need to experiment with Scala, that is an outcropping of a unique business need once you've covered the other bases. And people that reject frameworks without thinking carefully about the trade-offs are actually a huge liability, I've found. And I want to be, again, I'm saying this in a way that I don't want to villainize anyone, but I am saying that I think not considering trade-offs, I think anybody could agree that people who don't consider trade-offs and blindly charge in on principle can be pretty damaging. And I've now seen several companies who've been seriously hurt by that mentality because people get so fixated on some of these principles, whether it's test-driven development or it's a certain style of architecture, whether decoupling things in such a way that Rails is not the answer, so we're going to build it in Sinatra and build the perfect framework. Like, I wish I could go back in time and shake that person and say, like, what are you doing that's giving this business the ability to go absolutely, like, compete like nobody else in the marketplace? And I don't believe they could answer that. And it's partially is the onus is on business owners to be technical enough to be able to ask hard questions like that and push back on development teams who should need to be able to justify the unique business value of the stuff that they're adding. And hopefully you hire, you know, technical people and you can trust.
And I don't think that definitely having technical savvy is a good thing. But for those who don't, aren't super technically inclined, at least make sure that you have someone technical that you can trust that you can ask these questions. Like, are you devoting the majority of your creative energy to, you know, the furthering the business goals?
Yep. Yeah. One thing, kind of coming back. So my advice to business owners would be to work with people. Have a technical advisor that you can absolutely trust to come that understands the business domain, that understands trade-offs, that speaks in terms of trade-offs. Because if people speak in terms of absolutes, that's a really, really awesome red flag that you have a person that needs more guidance from somebody who understands more about trade-offs. And if you have put in charge of your technology somebody who deals in absolutes, run, do not walk to find a trusted advisor to justify a lot of those kind of decisions. But kind of coming back to, because what I want to make sure not to do is, you know, the people that espouse these views are not evil. And even though, like, you and I personally suffer a lot at the hands of people who've made architectural decisions we have no control over, and every developer does, some developers suffer at the hands of people who wrote code without thinking about any kind of test coverage or any kind of architectural decisions, who were just hurrying. It's really important not to villainize those people, because those people were us before and they will be us again. And so speaking to the individual developers who are in that spot, who are in the spot where they look around and they're so, like, dissatisfied, people I respect, you know, do tend to come to this conclusion sooner or later, that they look around at all the frameworks and they say, everything is terrible. I should probably just write my own. What advice would you give to those people?
What advice? I don't know if there's any advice.
If you could go back and give advice to yourself in that phase, would it just be like, hey, stick it out, it'll be fine, or what?
My advice would just be, keep at this and make sure that you stick with it and absorb all the pain. Like, be aware of the consequences of these actions, because no amount of advice is going to change your behavior unless you actually get to feel those consequences. So the advice would be self-aware of the things that you are missing, or the trade-offs, like you said, that you're sacrificing by going down this path. And usually it's pretty apparent, especially when, you know, you end up spending a lot of time maintaining your custom framework or your custom way of doing things, as opposed to actually writing stuff that does stuff. Like, actually writing your application and not the code to support your application.
The other thing is there is, you get a good feeling from shipping stuff, but isn't the feeling so much better when you ship something and people come back to you and tell you the impact that had on the business? Like, mm-hmm. you know that the thing that you did had a measurable positive impact on the business. If people, if we could like start moving culture a little bit more toward the reward cycle being tied around that, I think that would partially help. But also, I mean, and it's also,
you know what else I love? I love it when that happens and then they don't come back.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, that it actually worked and it was robust.
Yeah. You know, yeah, I was going to say,
like, I love that feeling where you don't have quality issues. Man, that's a great, like, I love shipping features and I love it being a thing and I love it being like, it works 2 years later. That is such a great feeling.
Yeah. And I guess that's such a good point and such a thing to be careful of is it's easy to get trapped in this cycle of the quick win. And the psychological, you know, like, you know, spray of whatever, you know, reward center we get and dopamine shot that we get from mm-hmm. somebody coming in and saying, hey, that had a measurable impact on the business. Give me another one of those and another one. And then you have an unmaintainable code base. And so being able to kind of push and pull on that stuff is really the role of a senior developer. And I guess what we've been kind of discussing today is largely, watching what happens when the scale tips too far and people become too jealous and too guarded of their precious, you know, like architecture, because the goal of that architecture is to allow somebody to come to you 2 years later and say, hey, thanks for doing that in a way that didn't cost me more money. But not measuring and understanding the concept of trade-offs on the way into that. You know, I've seen a lot of businesses with thoroughly engineered code bases that didn't ship enough to deserve the right to stay in business anymore. Mm-hmm. And, and I've seen the other too.
No, I mean, it doesn't have like, I guess, what do you mean when you say engineering? Like you're talking about, cause there's over engineering and, you know, the less is more.
Yeah. I guess I'm with you. I'm with you on writing as little code as possible, but sometimes it requires a lot of thought to write less code.
Yes.
And
sometimes I would say the majority of the time.
Yeah. It's the classic, I come from a writer background. It takes me easily 3 or 4 times, sometimes 5 or 6 times as long to write something that is half or a quarter the length that says the same thing, but it's possible.
Have you ever seen Wonder Boys?
No.
Oh man. Fantastic movie. The basic plot is there's this novelist who had a great first novel, came out to a lot of acclaim, and now he's writing his second follow-up, or he's writing his latest novel, and it's just this massive tome of 1,500 pages. And something happens, and he only has one copy, and it gets burned up or something like that. It gets lost, and they're riding away. I mean, there's a whole bunch of crazy stuff that happens, but the person in the car with him is saying, oh my goodness, you lost like your whole novel. And he's like, aren't you sad? And he's kind of like, no. And I'm doing a terrible, terrible job of retelling this anecdote. But but then, you know, she says, well, what was it about? You know, what was your book about? And he's like, I have no idea. And he's like, you wrote 1,500 pages without knowing what it was about? And he says, I couldn't stop.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's totally true. I have had that experience both in code and in writing prose.
I have it all the time. So anyway,
yeah. So I kind of coming back to that a little bit. Like what I would say is my hope for developers who find themselves in that position of like you can tell it's a red flag if you start reacting before you start considering trade-offs. Like notice that about your mm-hmm. your stuff and listen for that in your team culture. Because you'll notice it. Like if you're paying attention to that, pay attention to that being a red flag, and it does largely come from fear of obsolescence. And my recommendation, I heard a really great episode of Ruby Rogues recently with Dave Thomas, and he wrote this in The Pragmatic Programmer, which is be completely comfortable with the fact that your knowledge has a half-life of 18 months. 18 months from now, half the stuff that you know will be obsolete and pointless.
That's a great point.
Isn't that actually really wonderful because
it's liberating.
Yeah. It means you don't have to obsess over the perfection of an architecture. You go, this is technical debt waiting to happen because we will know more 18 months from now than we know right now. Your expertise. So be careful about building expertise around technology. We focus a lot on our Ember expertise here, but we know 18 months from now, half the crap we know about Ember will be useless. Either Ember will be wildly different or other things will come to light.
Or it'll just be common knowledge.
Yeah. Our expertise cannot be in technology. And how great is the expertise and how non-expiring is the kind of expertise that allows you to connect real business needs, like what makes a company money in the long term, and software. Knowing the balance between shipping things and quality, to understand those trade-offs, building that skill set. So like if you could go back in time and talk to yourself, and if I could go back in time and talk to myself, I think I would say the same thing. Like, stick with it, because what you're doing is you're building the experience to be able to walk into a room and help people balance those trade-offs. And that knowledge does not expire.
Right.
And you get to look for knowledge and patterns that don't change over the period of decades. That's pretty cool. So I guess that would be the, if I could dispense advice, which is my thing, that would definitely be it. It's just kind of stick through it.
We should rename this podcast the Brandon Hayes Advice Dispensary.
I cannot help it, Charles. I have a problem.
Next.
I'm like that book writer. I can't.
Here's
I can't,
your advice. Next.
I can't stop. It's my default mode. But yeah, it was.
I love it.
Yeah.
People love it.
Yeah,
people demand more.
Oh man. Well, I do enjoy our chats. We have fun. We have fun here on the internet.
Yep.
So yeah, I think that's what I would like to see from you, Charles, is a kind of a follow-up blog post with more of your thoughts on this. Cause I think there's more to say, and that would be nice to hear unpolluted and untainted by my own viewpoint. So
no,
I would love to read it is all I'm saying.
All right.
Okay.
All right. I think it's about a paragraph. If I can distill it to a paragraph, then I've put these principles into action.
Excellent.
I don't think I can achieve that,
but
that's what I'm going for.
All right. Well, Charles, have a great week. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Enjoy your weekend, dude.
You too. See ya.
All right. Bye.